Welcome to Immigration Review, your weekly source for immigration case law updates and insights. I'm your host, Kevin A. Gregg, back again to review the week's precedential immigration cases, rummaging through the decisions so you don't have to. This podcast is sponsored by Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, also known as KKTP, a law firm where I'm also a partner. Whether you are facing an immigration obstacle, a serious injury, or a legal issue in your business, KKTP will aggressively protect your best interests. This podcast is also sponsored by DocketWise, an all-in-one immigration forms and case management solution trusted by thousands of immigration lawyers across the U.S. I really like DocketWise. It makes immigration applications easy by allowing the clients to provide information through simple online questionnaires that are shareable by text or email and available in multiple languages. Not only that, DocketWise provides a comprehensive group of case management features, including invoicing and calendaring, secure messaging, task management, and a lot more. You can learn all about DocketWise and receive a 10% discount on your subscription by heading to docketwise.com/immigration-review, so they know we sent you. And as always, this show does not constitute legal advice and has no bias other than to keep you up to date and to enable you, my dear colleagues, to excel in court. So, without further ado, let's start the review. There were no wins for non-citizens this week. For that reason, I've decided to do something I've never done before and discuss not so much a case summary during this episode, but a case saga. I'll do it after this first Fifth Circuit decision. I'm talking about that because I've received many emails from listeners this week. The subject of that thing I'm about to talk about was just one of many and, quite frankly, the most egregious. I really appreciate everyone reaching out, and I love everything that I receive, from a photo with a podcast sticker to the law school exams that your emails often pose. Keep them coming, please. As to this week, as I alluded to, the decisions were so bad and complicated that I had to go reread two of them to make sure that I read them right, because I simply cannot understand how those courts got to the results that they did with straight faces. In fairness, I did not see the judges' faces. If you remain confused, angry, and slightly nauseous after this week, rest assured, it's not you, it's them. And so, without further ado, the podcast's big week of bad. Here we go. First is Membrano Rodriguez v. Garland, published by the Fifth Circuit on March 4th, 2024. This case is about motions to reopen and parole. Mr. Membrano Rodriguez is from Honduras and seems to have come to a port of entry in 2017, asking to come in, but the decision is a little unclear. He was given a credible fear interview, found to have one, and permitted to pursue his claim in removal proceedings, his asylum claim. He was later granted parole, explicitly it appears, under 8 CFR section 212.5b5. That is, he was released from immigration detention and given that parole. After his release from detention, Mr. Membrano Rodriguez lost his asylum case, and he was ordered removed. The BIA affirmed. Not physically removed, Mr. Membrano Rodriguez found love and married a U.S. citizen in 2020. He asked the BIA to reopen his case. DHS hadn't removed him in the interim, and now he had a U.S. citizen wife, and he might be able to get a green card, if only given the chance. And if that parole that he received is really considered a proper parole under immigration law. The BIA denied the motion to reopen. Also, the I-130 was merely pending and not approved when Mr. Membrano Rodriguez filed his motion with the BIA. And of course, you need an I-130 approved to adjust to LPR status through a marriage. But the I-130 was eventually approved, and Mr. Membrano Rodriguez submitted proof. So I have a feeling it actually was approved before the BIA denied. Yet the BIA still denied that motion to reopen. Usually that's not so remarkable, as the BIA denies motions to reopen all the time when the non-citizen has become prima facie eligible to adjust status. We can debate whether that's proper at a later time. But there's this big wrinkle in this decision. The BIA denied here, reasoning that despite the later parole that Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez received, quote, as he had conceded before the immigration judge, he is inadmissible under INA section 212A7AII and accordingly ineligible for adjustment of status under section 245A of the INA, end quote. And that's a much bigger deal than simply denying a motion to reopen. And maybe so, maybe he did concede that he was inadmissible under 212A7AII. And maybe he was removable as an applicant for admission without valid entry documents at his application for admission at first. But he was later paroled under ACFR section 212.5B5. Is that a parole that allows a non-citizen to adjust through a marriage? After all, and after consulting with the parole experts Mark Prada and Anthony Dominguez, it would seem that section 212.5 of the regulations is the regulatory section that implements INA section 212D5, which is the golden parole that permits adjustment. So it appears that Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez did indeed receive a section 212D5 qualifying parole, even if it later expired, as paroles often do, and even if it followed his simple release from immigration custody. Because it's a section 212D5 qualifying parole, it seems, all that nonsense from matter of Cabrera-Fernandez wouldn't apply. Perhaps that's why the Fifth Circuit doesn't cite that BIA decision. My apologies for having to guess a little and fill in so many gaps with this decision, but there are a lot of gaps. And nevertheless, the Fifth Circuit affirmed the BIA. To get there, the Fifth Circuit distinguished some non-citizen-friendly precedent, which quite frankly appears distinguishable. But nevertheless, that's a parole. How doesn't Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez qualify for adjustment? Motion to reopen notwithstanding. And this is the point of the decision where I couldn't understand what was going on. If he received a Section 212D5 qualifying parole, he's been inspected and admitted or paroled, as Section 245A requires to adjust, even if that parole expired. He's adjustment eligible. And if I'm being honest, and based on many of the litigation threads that I've been seeing, I'm pretty sure that my flummoxation is not alone. Dare I say the Fifth Circuit got it wrong? Well, to the court, Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez was and remained an applicant for admission, having been charged initially in removal proceedings under Section 212A7AII, and as one who conceded that charge. Whatever his parole was, it expired later on, explained the court. And under Section 1000.1Q of the regulations, Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez, quote, remained an applicant for admission at the time he filed his motion to reopen, regardless of the status of his parole, end quote. At a minimum, he reverted back to an applicant for admission when the parole expired, under the regulations, said the Fifth Circuit. Once an applicant for admission, always an applicant for admission, or at least usually one, after parole terminates or is revoked. Even if that initial parole is an adjustment of status qualifying Section 212D5 parole, it would appear. Which I guess means that the Fifth Circuit is holding, without saying it, that the IJ lacked authority to adjust Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez? So a motion to reopen would be pointless because IJs lack authority to adjust arriving alien applicants for admission, even with a qualifying parole? I really have no idea. The Fifth Circuit does not really explain itself in this terse yet consequential decision. That whole jurisdiction thing is one thing, and that is true. Generally, the regulations preclude IJs from adjusting individuals deemed arriving aliens. Because it can't be that the Fifth Circuit is saying that you can't adjust to LPR status in the United States if your parole has expired, can it? The adjustment of status statute is written in the past tense, section 245A, and permits adjustment to a qualifying individual who, quote, was inspected and admitted or paroled, end quote. If all the Fifth Circuit is really saying without saying it is that the IJ and the BIA lacked jurisdiction to adjust Mr. Membreno-Rodriguez because he remained an applicant for admission arriving alien, then USCIS should have authority to adjust him to LPR status, notwithstanding his removal order, so long as USCIS were to grant him an I-212 waiver of the removal order. USCIS pretty much always has authority to entertain the adjustment of status application of an arriving alien, even if he or she has been ordered removed. Just might need a waiver. But if the Fifth Circuit is ignoring the word was in the adjustment of status statute, and holding that an expired parole doesn't qualify for an adjustment of status, that's a big deal. Let's hope not. Go forth and apply with USCIS, Mr. Membreno Rodriguez. I haven't seen the immigration bar this up in arms about a decision in a minute. At least until the 11th Circuit published their decision this week. Terrible decision for non-citizens in the 5th Circuit that I don't quite understand, and for adjustment of status seekers everywhere. While we're with the 5th Circuit, the 5th Circuit amended its non-citizen adverse Mejia Alvarenga v. Garland decision this week after a failed en banc attempt, but it doesn't seem very substantive, so check out episode 193 for a refresher. And that is Membreno Rodriguez v. Garland. Next, and kind of sticking with the Fifth Circuit, we have the saga of Mr. Niken Glafek. Do you remember the case Niken Glafek v. Garland? The case about the Cameroonian asylum seeker, credibility, and perceived discrepancies? Episode 108. Or how about Niken Glafek v. Garland II, the aptly named Return of the Fack, in which none other than the Fifth Circuit held that the Department of Justice was so wrong to defend the IJ and the BIA's decision, that the credibility decision was unsubstantially justified, that Mr. Niken Glafek's attorneys got attorney's fees under the Equal Access to Justice Act? Still the only petition for review Ija Win discussed so far on the podcast, if I'm not mistaken. Episode 153. And this after ICE physically deported Mr. Niken Glafek back to Cameroon during his petition for review. The place, again, from which none other than the Fifth Circuit sees a possible persecution claim. Well, that attorney was Homero Lopez Jr., legal director of ISLA Immigration. ISLA is a pro bono entity operating in Louisiana doing the work that almost no removal defense attorneys want to do or have capacity to do. They represent hundreds if not thousands of non-citizens detained in the difficult to reach ICE detention centers in rural Louisiana and the surrounding areas. For free. So, on Tuesday, Homero wrote me to tell me that despite the BIA sending Niken Glafek back to the immigration judge for further asylum proceedings 1 year ago, which, quite frankly, it really kind of had to do after DOJ was ordered to pay Homero's nonprofit $50,000, and which was itself a year after the Fifth Circuit's decision, ICE has still not facilitated Mr. Niken Glafek's return from Cameroon. It has been 2 years. This is from Homero, quote, ICE has approved his parole, told us everything is in order for him to come back, and he's now been to the airport 3 times and turned away each time, recently almost getting arrested, because apparently DHS and the Department of State have not properly informed or followed through on various clearances necessary. It has been one of the most frustrating issues I've ever dealt with, and I primarily practice in detention in Louisiana. End quote. Indeed. 2 years post a Fifth Circuit decision holding that EOIR was wrong to the tune of $50,000, and with a literal active asylum case going on from Cameroon, and Mr. Niken Glafek remains stuck in Cameroon with a surely cash-strapped nonprofit trying to get him back from 10,000 miles away. If anyone in Washington has some sway with the relevant agencies, now might be a worthy time to nudge. Thanks for letting me know, Homero. And thank you for the work that you do. Links in the show notes. And hopefully updating everybody on Mr. Niken Glafek's saga in a more positive way in the future. And that is the saga of Mr. Niken Glafek. Next is Reyes Galeana v. Garland, published by the Sixth Circuit on March 4th, 2024. The Sixth Circuit is back with another decision authored by the individual who was once, technically, the ultimate political head of oil. This case is about particular social groups. The Sixth Circuit describes Ms. Reyes-Galeana as, quote, a former restaurateur, end quote, who fled to the United States from Mexico with her three daughters. She asserted that she had been targeted in Mexico and feared persecution in the future based on her membership at the particular social group of Mexican business owners. Seems like she was extorted in Guerrero State by unnamed individuals shortly after opening a restaurant there. After multiple demands and seemingly death threats, she fled to the United States with her children. Seems like the immigration judge and the BIA believed her, but didn't think that Mexican business owners is actually a particular social group, meaning that it doesn't really matter what happened to Ms. Reyes-Galeana in Mexico or who she fears, because it's not for the right reasons to get safety in the United States. The Sixth Circuit agreed. Exercising de novo review, by the way, on something it sees as a purely legal question. While the Sixth Circuit recognizes that it itself recently said in Tercios Flores v. Garland, episode 158, that land ownership is fundamental to an individual's identity, a very similar issue that strongly implies that the group here is immutable, the Sixth Circuit here didn't believe that this group, at a minimum, was particular or socially distinct in Mexico. Restated, maybe business ownership is or is not an immutable characteristic in Mexico, but the court doesn't believe it particular or socially distinct. Tercios Flores v. Garland is a bomber of a decision, by the way, and I recommend reviewing it regularly. Back to this case, particularity requires that the, quote, group has discrete and definable boundaries, end quote. To the Sixth Circuit here, though, the proposed group covers anyone who has, quote, ventured into the Mexican marketplace as owners of businesses, end quote. To the court, that group has no limits on size, the nature of commercial affairs, or even the individual's business's location. Quote, there's virtually no unifying relationship or characteristic narrowing this group of individuals, end quote. A common thread of susceptibility to extortion is insufficient, explained the Sixth Circuit. Nor is the particular social group socially distinct under BIA precedent defining that particular social group requirement. Ms. Reyes-Galeana apparently did not submit evidence showing that Mexican society sees Mexican business owners as a group, and even if Mexican society does recognize them as a group at risk of extortion, there are many such groups to which that applies. Under BIA precedent, as it's developed at this point, you really need a country condition expert, unfortunately. How else can you meet your evidence burden to show what a foreign society thinks? I mean, there are ways, but experts are often vital and expensive. But for those reasons here, Ms. Reyes-Galeana and her daughters lost their case and may be removed to Mexico. Let's return to Tercios Flores, shall we? Admittedly, I went back to that decision to remind myself and now to remind everyone that in addition to finding that land ownership is immutable in Honduras, the Sixth Circuit said in Tercios Flores that, quote, single mothers living without male protection is socially distinct, end quote, in Honduras. So remember that. And in reviewing my notes, it would appear that the judge who authored this decision, Judge Riedler, was on the Tercios Flores panel and dissented from most of it. So it is perhaps unsurprising that the judge is not eager to expand the decision here. And that is Reyes-Galeana v. Garland. Turning now to a trio of Eighth Circuit decisions, and we'll do them in the order that they were published. First, Herrera Elias v. Garland, published by the Eighth on March 4th, 2024. If you haven't got it yet, March 4th was a big day. This case is about serious non-political crimes. Mr. Herrera Elias is from Honduras, where he was recruited into MS-13 at the age of 13. He transported drugs and guns twice for the gang as a child because he was, quote, trying to fit in, end quote, and because they threatened to murder him. When the man who was recruiting him was murdered himself, Mr. Herrera Elias fled to the United States with the help of his family, seemingly as a child. As it turns out, he's also gay, but he never let anyone know this in Honduras. The immigration judge denied relief and protection in a, quote, lengthy, end quote, decision. Looks like actually the asylum application was untimely as it hadn't been submitted within 1 year of Mr. Herrera Elias' entry into the United States. Then, despite the evidence showing that Mr. Herrera Elias did all these bad things at 13 and 14 years old, and that some, if not all of it, occurred under duress, the IJ believed that there were serious reasons for believing that Mr. Herrera Elias had committed a serious non-political crime in Honduras, which barred him from withholding of removal. Convention Against Torture deferral denied on the merits. The BIA affirmed in a split decision. Namely, at the BIA, quote, one member of the three-judge panel dissented from this ruling, concluding based on Mr. Herrera Elias's young age and limited involvement in the gang's operations that his conduct does not constitute a serious non-political crime, end quote. Give us names, Eighth Circuit. Who art thou, BIA dissenter? The Eighth Circuit affirmed the BIA majority. As I mentioned, it really came down to the serious non-political crime stuff. That bar to asylum and withholding of removal is found at INA Section 208B2AI for asylum and Section 241B3BI for withholding of removal. In the one decision not reactive to his predecessors, Attorney General Garland has held that, at least for particularly serious crimes, another bar to asylum and withholding of removal, mental health issues may excuse convictions that might otherwise be deemed particularly serious. That's a matter of BZR, Episode 107. Similarly, in the Eighth Circuit and at the BIA, the serious non-political crime bar, which does not require a conviction, demands a case-by-case analysis. At the BIA, that's the 2012 decision matter of EA. Not only that, but in Barahona v. Garland, Episode 41, the Eighth Circuit recently remanded a case where the non-citizen was accused of being a hitman in an Interpol red notice, if I'm not mistaken, but the charge had been dismissed and the Eighth Circuit wasn't so sure about the reliability of the red notice. Forgot about that one. That's a good one on the serious non-political crime bar. Did an Interpol red notice on a dismissed charge from a country that might abuse Interpol red notices give an immigration judge serious reasons for believing that a serious non-political crime had been committed? Barahona v. Garland. So that same serious non-political crime bar to asylum and withholding is what's at issue right now, but unfortunately for Mr. Herrera Elias, there is no doubt that he did these things. He was completely honest with the court and was hoping that the court would excuse the two instances of drug and gun transport that he did as a young teenager to fit in, and then after being threatened with death by one of the most dangerous gangs in the world. The Eighth Circuit also seems to believe that the duress argument is supported by country condition evidence, that is, that the gang, MS-13, regularly targets, quote, law-abiding Hondurans, end quote. Again, 13 years old on this decision. But to the court, quote, the BIA's ruling that the fact that Mr. Herrera Elias was a minor when the crimes were committed does not exempt his crimes from being considered particularly serious, end quote. Even though the serious non-political crime bar requires a case-by-case analysis, the Eighth Circuit believes that such a holding is consistent with a 2004 decision out of the Eighth Circuit. As such, Mr. Herrera Elias may get physically removed. Cat deferral was apparently not challenged before the Eighth Circuit, which would not be subject to the serious non-political crime bar. Before we move on, in a footnote, and because Mr. Herrera Elias relied on it, the Eighth Circuit reminded me and all of us that matter of Negus, or Negusi, remains unresolved. That is, whether there's a duress exception to the persecutor bar to asylum and withholding is still pending before Attorney General Garland. Where you at, AG? And if anyone, truly, can provide me a rational reason for why immigration law doesn't have a duress exception for the persecutor bar, serious non-political crime bar, terrorism grounds, and similar bars and provisions of the INA, I'd love to hear it. It does seem exceptionally unfair and the catchiest of 22s to punish asylum seekers for giving in to the demands of their persecutors after having suffered or been threatened themselves with persecution before fleeing. But that's just me. And that is Herrera Elias v. Garland. Next is Thagula v. Jadot, published by the Eighth Circuit on March 5th, 2024. This case is about adjustment of status delays. Dare I call it waiting for Godot? Too decent of a pun not to do. But actually, it's the Department of State and U.S. immigration law more generally that's to blame here. And not so much the USCIS director. The Thagulas are Indians. They've lived in the United States as non-immigrants for a long time and have had adjustment of status applications pending for a long time, seemingly in the E2 employment category. That's professionals holding advanced degrees and persons of exceptional ability. They're technically eligible to adjust LPR status provided that they otherwise qualify. To start this process, people like the Thagulas need to receive an approved labor certificate from the Department of Labor and an approved I-140 petition, the employment equivalent of an I-130 petition for family-type immigration, from USCIS. The Thagulas received both a long time ago. Also, unmentioned here, but if the Thagulas go out of non-immigrant status for over 6 months or work without authorization for over 6 months, they'll likely be barred from ever adjusting to LPR status in the United States, at least in an employment category. Tough life. But the Thagulas did indeed maintain their non-immigrant status throughout this whole many-year ordeal. So why can't they adjust? Because as non-immediate relative categories of immigrant visas, there are caps leading to backlogs. And India's got a lot of applicants, leading to even more backlogs for Indians in these backlogged categories. And again, I believe that this is in the E2 category here. The Thagulas applied in January of 2014 and received a priority date of January 17, 2014 for their application. That priority date was not current when they applied, meaning it wasn't at the front of the backlog. And it didn't become current for nearly 9 years. But in September 2022, it became current, which resulted in a crazy rush of applications, but especially applications from Indians, in September 2022. And then, the next month, in October of 2022, the priority date retrogressed 2.5 years, leaving people like the Thagulas back in the Visa Bulletin Adjustment of Status purgatory. USCIS issued an administrative hold policy over applications that were once current and that had been filed but that were no longer current, like the Thagulas. And it's actually gotten even worse, not better, since September of 2022. As of today, E2s for Indians are current if they have a priority date of March 1st, 2012. It's a 12-year delay. Wild. With nothing really to lose except money, quote, the Thagulas sued to compel USCIS to promptly adjudicate their status adjustment applications, arguing that the decision to delay adjudicating them pursuant to the adjudication hold policy violates congressional intent, end quote. This all is traveling under the Administrative Procedures Act. The district court dismissed their complaint, and the Eighth Circuit affirmed. No subject matter jurisdiction, said the court. That's, of course, an unwaivable requirement for any federal court litigation. Just ask Trina Realmuto. Now true, precedent holds that there is a presumption in favor of judicial review of administrative action or inaction, and there are APA grounds to challenge unreasonable agency delay. The Thagulas argue that this administrative hold policy that USCIS is adopting goes against congressional intent. But the Eighth Circuit believes that the statutory text is the best place to find congressional intent. And to the court, INA Section 245A, the Adjustment of Status statute that we talked about in that Fifth Circuit decision, shows that Congress intended for USCIS to have discretion to adjust or not to adjust non-citizens to LPR status, even if they meet all of the statutory requirements. And so, here comes the gut punch. Our old friend Patel. Under the Supreme Court's recent Patel decision, explains the Eighth Circuit, INA Section 242A2BI, quote, bars a court's jurisdiction to review a judgment granting a status adjustment application, end quote. Fair enough, even if that's not necessarily settled and makes me want to vomit. But even if that's true, the Eighth Circuit then extended it and explained that, quote, in the same way, the statute bars this court's jurisdiction to review the decision to delay adjudicating the status adjustment, end quote. Say it ain't so. It's really our biggest fears coming to fruition. Will Patel ultimately kill challenges to agency delay? You did not hear it here first. I will not be that Cassandra. In any event, as a discretionary form of relief that expressly says that USCIS may adjust an applicant's status rather than shall do so, quote, congressional intent is clear. The decision to delay adjudicating the Thagula's status adjustment applications based on the creation of the adjudication hold policy was within USCIS's discretionary authority, end quote. Even if DHS's and therefore USCIS's implementing and governing regulations might provide a contrary argument, quote, if the statute specifies that the decision is wholly discretionary, regulations or agency practice will not make the decision reviewable, end quote. And the Eighth Circuit believes that Section 245A is clear and divests the court of jurisdiction from hearing this case. Relying also on Barbera v. Blinken out of the Ninth Circuit, Episode 188, the Eighth Circuit sees no statutory conflict. The Adjustment of Status statute, explained the court, requires a visa to be available when an applicant's LPR Adjustment of Status application is approved, irrespective of what the situation was when that application was filed. So, if a retrogression happens during its pendency, as occurred here, non-immigrant applicants, like E2 Indian visa applicants, are screwed. The Eighth Circuit noted that the INA does permit review of arguments like this through the petition for review process, but not, like here, through a district court lawsuit and then an appeal. Of course, it is legally impossible to bring a claim like this through the petition for review process, but that is not discussed. Or maybe it's just not a problem to the court, as it appeared unproblematic to the Patel majority as well, albeit in dicta. In any event, it meant that this lawsuit was dismissed. The Thagulas must continue to wait, and with no end in sight. If their children were not born in the United States, they will likely eventually age out once they turn 21 if they haven't already, meaning that they'll become visa dreamers and be forced to essentially forever continue their schooling in America to retain their status, find U.S. citizen love, or leave the country that they were raised in. Check out the podcast's April 27, 2022 interview with some of those visa dreamers for all about that. And that is Thagula v. Jadot. Rounding out the Eighth Circuit, we have Yar v. Garland, published by the Eighth on March 8, 2024. This is a short one from the Eighth Circuit on Convention Against Torture Protection, as the Eighth Circuit is apt to do. Mr. Yar is from South Sudan and entered the United States as a refugee, as a teenager, in 2003, before there was even a South Sudan. That probably had something to do with how he got refugee status in the first place. Didn't adjust LPR status. Didn't naturalize. Distributed meth. Removable. And in quite the problematic way, because under Attorney General Ashcroft's decision, if I'm not mistaken, in matter of YL, drug trafficking crimes, or at least drug trafficking aggravated felonies, are almost always particularly serious crimes that bar asylum and withholding of removal. Of course, there are arguments, including that the Attorney General didn't have the authority to make such a categorical rule in YL, but that is not what this decision is about. Unstated, but probably because of matter of YL, Mr. Yar applied only, or at least had decided, an application for Convention Against Torture deferral of removal. Something that has no bar. And wouldn't you know it, quote, the immigration judge concluded that it was more likely than not that the government of South Sudan, led by the majority Dinka tribe, would torture Mr. Yar based on his membership in the minority Nuer tribe and his relationship to his father, who was an advocate for South Sudanese independence who died under suspicious circumstances in 2006, end quote. Unpleased with that, DHS decided to appeal, and the BIA reversed the IJ. Among other things, the BIA, quote, concluded that a chance that ethnic cleansing and large-scale conflict would erupt falls short of meeting the requirement to prove that torture is more likely than not to occur, end quote. To the Eighth Circuit it went, where the best argument in these type of procedural cases was made, that the BIA engaged in improper fact-finding, which the BIA can't do. But the Eighth Circuit disagreed. The BIA, quote, accepted the immigration judge's factual findings on what events would or might occur in South Sudan and only then reviewed de novo whether the predicted future acts or events would constitute torture. The definition of torture is a legal issue, and whether a predicted factual outcome meets the definition of torture is a question of law that the BIA properly considers de novo, end quote. Very important to remember in your BIA appeals when the IJ denies cat protection, folks. But it hurt Mr. Yarhir, because the BIA did not reject facts, according to the Eighth Circuit. It just took those facts, applied them to the torture definition, and found them lacking, said the Eighth Circuit. As to whether the BIA's analysis was correct, the Eighth Circuit had no problem with it. Even if Mr. Yar might be detained when he landed in South Sudan at the airport or thereafter, the BIA, quote, correctly determined that a likelihood of detention or imprisonment by itself does not amount to torture, end quote. Nor was evidence of what's happening in South Sudan, even if it's flagrant or indicative of mass human rights violations, sufficient without a showing of torture particular to the applicant. Unstated by the Eighth Circuit, I guess Mr. Yar's connection to his father that died under mysterious circumstances and who was a political advocate just wasn't enough. So the Eighth Circuit affirmed the BIA and not the immigration judge. And that is Yar v. Garland. Are you tired of answering your own phones or of wasting your valuable time on unqualified consultations? Staffy Live is the only 24/7 live receptionist and intake service specialized on immigration law. Staffy Live specialists are highly empathetic, bilingual individuals who know how to deal with adversity, have a background in client care, and are trained to qualify callers by asking the right questions. Staffy Live goes one step ahead in only scheduling qualified consultations on your calendar and then doing follow-ups when needed. Staffy Live is giving a 15-day free trial for any law firm interested with no strings attached. To apply, visit www.getstaffy.com. That's GETSTAFI.com. And click on Get Started. Make sure to put in the code FREE. Links, of course, in the show notes. This podcast is sponsored by Driftwood Capital. Driftwood Capital boasts a 30-plus year track record, transacting on more than $3 billion in hospitality assets. Since 2015, Driftwood Capital has successfully implemented the EB-5 program into their development deals, helping more than 160 families find a secure path to residency through their projects. Driftwood Capital is a vertically integrated commercial real estate firm specializing in hospitality with dedicated acquisitions, development, lending, and management divisions. Their goal is to create long-term partnerships with its network of more than 1,200 active investors from the United States and abroad, while targeting attractive returns. Driftwood's unique approach involves managing all aspects in-house, from developing renowned hotel brands such as Marriott, Hilton, and Hyatt, to managing their portfolio of more than 80 hotels in the United States. If you want to learn more about Driftwood Capital, check out the show notes. And of course, let them know who sent you. Moving on to Miguel Pena et al. V. Garland, published by the 10th Circuit on March 4th, 2024. March 4th again. And it's a big old bad one on exhaustion and asylum. Miss Miguel Pena and her minor daughter are the petitioners here, and they're from El Salvador. They came to the United States in 2016 and brought an asylum claim in immigration court, but not before moving to terminate their removal proceedings in 2019, because the notice to appear was deficient, didn't have the date, time, location, or maybe all three, of Ms. Miguel Pena's first hearing. Quote, the IJ denied petitioner's motion to terminate without explanation, end quote. Going then to the merits of their case, it was essentially an MS-13 extortion-type claim. The IJ denied that too, believing that a fear of MS-13 for refusing to pay extortion doesn't qualify for asylum, in so many words. The BIA affirmed both the denial of the motion to terminate and the denial of asylum. To the Tenth Circuit it went, after some Santos Zacharia-inspired supplemental briefing about jurisdiction, exhaustion, and claims processing rules. The Tenth Circuit affirmed the agency. First, on termination, unfortunately, and despite the Supreme Court's Santos-Zacharia holding that a failure to exhaust an argument is not a jurisdictional flaw, the Tenth Circuit said that it couldn't review whether termination was required due to DHS's failure to comply with a mandatory claims processing rule in initiating removal proceedings through a deficient NTA. See, it looks like that, like so many attorneys, after the Supreme Court's Pereira decision, Ms. Miguel Pena, or her counsel, argued that the NTA deficiency was a jurisdictional flaw. But Ms. Miguel Pena then abandoned that argument once all the courts started holding, no, it's not. Ms. Miguel Pena did not pivot to a claims processing rule argument, though, until the circuit court level, it appears. She argued instead to the BIA that a failure to provide a compliant NTA to a non-citizen to initiate removal proceedings violates a non-citizen's due process rights. Which is kind of what a claims processing rule is designed to protect, right? But whatever the merits of that, said the Tenth Circuit, that's not a claims processing rule argument. Which, to be uber confusing, is also what exhaustion before a circuit of an argument is. It, too, is a claims processing rule that must be complied with before the circuit, and I guess the BIA, can review an argument. But because it's no longer jurisdictional, that is, exhaustion of an argument, it theoretically can be waived because it's a claims processing rule, that is, exhaustion. So in essence here, Ms. Miguel Pena's failure to raise a mandatory claims processing rule violation argument here was itself a violation of a mandatory claims processing rule. Sorry, but I simply cannot help myself. And it seems that the only difference to the Tenth Circuit between exhaustion being a claims processing rule versus jurisdictional is that a non-citizen's failure to exhaust an argument can be waived by OIL now. But exhaustion is still mandatory, even in claims processing rule form. And if OIL timely asserts it, well, the non-citizen's in trouble before the Tenth Circuit. Regardless of the legal rationale of appellate exhaustion, in the Tenth Circuit, a non-citizen, quote, must present the same specific legal theory to the BIA before he or she may advance it in the circuit court, end quote. That's a very narrow exhaustion requirement as compared to some other circuits. And again, just a step back, the mandatory claims processing rule violation that Ms. Miguel Pena is alleging that DHS violated is complying with INA Section 239A, and providing a compliant notice to appear. But the mandatory claims processing rule that the Tenth Circuit is saying that Ms. Miguel Pena herself violated is a failure to make that specific argument before the BIA. The greater sin to the Tenth Circuit is Ms. Miguel Pena's violation of a mandatory claims processing rule, because it means that she's not even getting review of what everybody agrees is DHS's initial violation of a mandatory claims processing rule. Reason to the Tenth Circuit. Just as the Supreme Court's Chenery Doctrine prevents a circuit from affirming an agency decision on a basis that the agency didn't use, so too can a circuit court not consider a non-citizen's argument not made before the agency. This despite the fact, as the Tenth Circuit recognizes in a footnote, quote, the BIA itself misconstrued petitioner's due process argument when it stated the NTA defects did not deprive the IJ of jurisdiction, end quote. That is, the BIA denied Ms. Miguel Pena's NTA-based argument by saying she was making a jurisdictional argument that she actually wasn't making. Recall, she was making a due process argument. And let me tell you, as someone who has had a solely claims processing rule argument that doesn't even use the word jurisdiction, denied by the BIA as a misconstrued jurisdictional argument, well, it's infuriating. But whatever error the BIA made, and it made one, that due process argument wasn't a claims processing rule argument, so the Tenth Circuit didn't believe that it could review the argument for the first time, that is, claims processing, on petition for review. Even if it all goes back to deficiencies in the NTA. Remember, I said this was a long decision, and I do apologize for having gone on a few tangents, but I gotta keep going. Explain the Tenth Circuit. It is true that, quote, in some circumstances, a court may be permitted but not obliged to consider sua sponte whether a party has complied with a non-jurisdictional claims processing rule, end quote. That's Dave V. McDonough out of the Supreme Court, and it's a smart argument. That is, maybe a violation of a claims processing rule argument isn't subject, necessarily, to exhaustion. Or that is, a court can accept the violation, the failure to argue below. But not when it comes to immigration, said the Tenth Circuit. Quote, it is a fundamental principle of administrative law that an agency must have the opportunity to rule on a challenger's argument before the challenger may bring those arguments to court, end quote. That's one of the exceptions to that day exception in and of itself. Therefore, regardless of what Oil argued or even waived or forfeited, it seems, the Tenth Circuit believes that it can't let a failure to argue a specific deficient NTA argument below fly. 19 pages to explain why the Tenth Circuit will not address termination on the basis of a mandatory claims processing rule violation by DHS and an NTA that everybody agrees DHS did. Which brings us to the asylum claim. Ms. Miguel Pena's exhaustively exhausted claims were that A, she was persecuted and feared future persecution on account of her anti-gang political opinion, and B, that, quote, women business owners in El Salvador, end quote, is a cognizable particular social group. The Tenth Circuit did not agree. Quote, where there is no evidence that the persecutor would be hostile towards the targeted individuals absent their financial or recruitment motives, there is no nexus to a protected ground, end quote. Political opinion and particular social group claims were made. On political opinion, even if the BIA focused largely, if not exclusively, on MS-13's motives in extorting Ms. Miguel Pena rather than her purported anti-gang political opinion, said the Tenth Circuit, that wasn't improper, as the persecutor's motives are important. Nor was there evidence, to the court, that MS-13 knew of her anti-gang political opinion, or that really was what was motivating them, or motivating her, not to give them extortion monies. As to the particular social group, the Tenth Circuit has held previously that many, quote, employment-based groups are not immutable and therefore are not particular social groups, end quote. Immutability, of course, being the first of the three elements required to make a group a particular social group, what we touched on in the Sixth Circuit decision earlier. In any event, the Tenth Circuit believes that the record here shows that there were alternative options for employment available to Ms. Miguel Pena, thereby undermining an immutability finding. Quoting Matter of Acosta from all those years ago, the Tenth Circuit says, quote, the internationally accepted concept of a refugee simply does not guarantee an individual a right to work in the job of his choice, meaning that an asylum applicant may be required to change jobs to avoid future persecution, end quote. Then again, recall Tercios Flores out of the Sixth Circuit. See also CCV Holder out of the Seventh Circuit and Placarte Sociedad Vigarla out of the Ninth Circuit, episode 69, for non-citizen favorable employment-based particular social group decisions that were, to be fair, distinguished by the Tenth Circuit in its final footnote here. And it all meant that Ms. Miguel Pena and her minor daughter did not win the day. And that is Miguel Pena et al. Vigarla. It's been a long one, I know, but we arrive at Edwards v. Attorney General of the U.S., published by the 11th Circuit on March 6, 2024, on panel rehearing. In this case, the 11th Circuit panel has vacated its prior decision discussed on episode 139. But this opinion here is, quote, in all material respects, the same as our earlier one, except that we explain in more detail why we must apply the retroactivity rule, end quote. I appreciate the summary, 11th Circuit, I'll give you that. As such, I will only be discussing that portion of the decision and Judge Jordan's new concurrence in judgment. I respectfully direct you back to episode 139 for a lot of the other details and holdings. But suffice it to say, not only does that decision and this new one hold that Attorney General Barr's decision in matter of Thomas and Thompson is A-OK, but it reaffirms that the decision applies retroactively to criminal convictions that are modified or clarified, etc., even where all of that modification and clarification occurred pre-Thomas and Thompson. And I believe that the 11th Circuit is the only circuit to have held that Thomas and Thompson can be applied retroactively as such. So that's kind of a big deal. Recall, Thomas and Thompson essentially makes matter of Pickering the only standard to apply when a state court modifies or clarifies or vacates a criminal conviction, and that now, after Thomas and Thompson, having itself overturned 3 BIA decisions, only post-conviction relief that occurs for procedural or substantive defects in the original conviction will be recognized under immigration law. A non-citizen can have their whole conviction modified or clarified or vacated, but if it's not for the right reasons, it still could get them deported. In this decision, the 11th Circuit now explains in detail why it is Attorney General Barr had the authority to do what he did in Thomas and Thompson, and that Thomas and Thompson applies retroactively. And that's mainly because of the 11th Circuit's 2009 decision in U v. U.S. Attorney General. Explain the 11th Circuit. The INA clearly gives the Attorney General authority to interpret immigration law, and the Attorney General long ago properly delegated that authority to the BIA. Now, Mr. Edwards argued that if the Attorney General is going to exercise his or her authority, he or she must do so through notice and comment rulemaking. The Attorney General can't just take and overturn whatever the BIA is doing based on the wishes of the Attorney General and completely change immigration law, argued Mr. Edwards. The Attorney General, like the Department of Justice more generally in pretty much all other contexts, must go through the laborious notice and comment rulemaking process that is done to amend regulations, something that Attorney General Garland and the Department of Justice have ostensibly been doing since 2021 for other immigration provisions. The 11th Circuit rejected these arguments. It's appropriate to do what the Trump administration did, issue like 20 precedential decisions in 4 years, reinterpreting immigration law in a manner that aligns with the political values of the president. Quote, it is well established that agencies have discretion to choose whether to proceed by rulemaking or adjudication. That is even true when adjudication is used to announce new policy after years of contrary precedent, end quote. As occurred with Thomas and Thompson. And when the Attorney General does it, at least with Thomas and Thompson, but doesn't really look like it's limited, it can be applied retroactively. This notwithstanding that there is a presumption that agency action should not be applied retroactively to conduct that occurred pre-change to an agency rule. The reason for that, the reason the 11th Circuit doesn't really care about this long-standing presumption against retroactivity, is because to the panel, it's decision in U. In that decision, the 11th Circuit explained that when the Attorney General changes something in immigration law, the Attorney General does not in fact, quote, retroactively apply a new law, but instead applies the determination of what the law has always meant, end quote. So that's what the 11th Circuit sees as having happened here with Thomas and Thompson. This despite the fact that at the time Mr. Edwards got his sentence modified, BIA precedent, and therefore literally the law, would have recognized his sentence modification. Not only that, binding precedent issued by the former Fifth Circuit, before the 11th Circuit broke off from the Fifth Circuit, and which in all other cases binds the 11th Circuit, would require the 11th Circuit to actually conduct a balancing test under SEC v. Chenery to see if it's fair to apply this new agency rule retroactively. And that former Fifth Circuit decision requiring Chenery balancing, quote, was decided long before you, and it might appear that our prior panel precedent rule requires us to follow that earlier decision, end quote. But appearances would deceive you, explained the 11th Circuit. This panel here can't say that the U decision is wrong, or at least it has a duty to reconcile that decision with that prior Fifth Circuit decision, McDonald, if it can. That's 11th Circuit appellate procedure. And here, two of the judges on the panel think that you can reconcile the decisions. On the one hand, you have the U decision, which, quote, is specific to the immigration context, end quote. On the other hand, you have the McDonald decision, which involves, quote, the Bureau of Land Management and the Interior Board of Land Appeals, and resulted in extreme prejudice to hundreds of oil and gas lease applicants, end quote. So that's the distinction. Saying the quiet part out loud, 11th Circuit. Doesn't matter that both decisions regard administrative agencies, or for that matter that Chenery did too. To the 11th Circuit, quote, if you overlooked or misinterpreted Chenery, that would change nothing about its binding effect on our panel, end quote. At the end of the day, explained the court, INA Section 103A1 provides the Attorney General, including Attorney General Garland, quote, the final say on questions of immigration law, end quote. So when the Attorney General speaks, reasoned the 11th Circuit, he or she is saying what immigration law has always meant. He or she just hadn't got around to saying it yet. Satisfied that Attorney General Barr had the authority to do what he did, the 11th Circuit again applied the same Chevron deference analysis that it did last time around. Deference, quote, of special importance in the immigration context, end quote. A quote that just so seems designed to get out in front of the imminent death of Chevron and Loper Bright to set the groundwork for a possible immigration exception to the Supreme Court's forthcoming rule that administrative agencies are no longer owed deference. If, of course, I'm being a cynic, which I never am. The rest of this decision is largely the same as Episode 139's summary. Thomas and Thompson is a fine decision, and it is applied retroactive in the 11th Circuit. By the way, though, to remind everyone, here the 11th Circuit again refused to extend the clear and quite frankly unambiguous and controlling logic of the Supreme Court's Nasrallah decision, and to permit review of factual issues underlying the denial of withholding of removal for non-citizens with otherwise jurisdiction barring criminal convictions. That's a very complicated issue, so go back to episode 139, but to summarize, Nasrallah held that courts can review such factual issues for Convention Against Torture denial because CAT is separate from a final order of removal, and the jurisdiction stripping provision is tethered to a final order of removal. And of course, withholding of removal is also separate from a final order of removal, so it's the exact same logic. But the 11th Circuit has, again in this decision, refused to extend the clear logic of Nasrallah to withholding of removal, because technically, Nasrallah was only about CAT protection. That makes the 11th Circuit the only circuit to so hold on the issue, as well as the only circuit to apply Thomas and Thompson retroactively. I'd say it's a double gong, but no circuit except the 11th Circuit, to my recollection, has squarely addressed the withholding of removal review issue post-Nasrallah. So it'll just be a single gong for now. And of course, Mr. Edwards lost his case again. Here's Judge Jordan in concurrence before we go. Judge Jordan did not join the retroactivity stuff that I just discussed. Well, he joined it because he thinks he has to, but he also thinks that the Yu decision was plainly wrong in 2009 and conflicts with that prior precedent out of the former Fifth Circuit, McDonald, and the Supreme Court's Chenery decision, and that the 11th Circuit needs to go en banc to resolve it. Also, Judge Jordan recognizes that matter of Thomas and Thompson resulted in, quote, significant potential consequences for Mr. Edwards, end quote. Dare I say concerns comparable to oil and gas applicants? On retroactivity, to Judge Jordan, quote, the more an agency acts like a legislator, announcing new rules of general applicability, the closer it comes to the norm of legislations and the stronger the case becomes for limiting application of the agency's decision to future conduct, end quote. That is, if the Attorney General is going to act like a legislature and make rules that look like the Attorney General is legislating, the Attorney General's new rule should at a minimum be held to the presumption against retroactive effect that governs legislatures. The current state of affairs, where attorneys general can just come in and overturn precedent and have it be retroactive, quote, is tantamount to chaos, end quote, says Judge Jordan. Perhaps most importantly, also saying the quiet part out loud, Judge Jordan says, quote, there is no immigration exception. to the balancing test laid out in Chenery for the retroactivity of administrative decisions, end quote. I think I'll end with that. And that is Edwards v. Attorney General of the United States. So there you have it. You're all caught up with the past week's published immigration cases. I'm Kevin A. Gregg, a partner with the law firm Kurzban, Kurzban, Tetzeli & Pratt, and this has been another episode of Immigration Review. Thank you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed it. If you did, please share it with a friend and rate and review us. Each review helps new listeners find the show. And of course, subscribe to Immigration Review wherever you get your podcasts. If you like what we do and want to become a patron of the show, please check out our Patreon page at www.patreon.com/immigrationreview or click on the link in the show notes. And if you're interested in an official Immigration Review CLE certificate, email me at kgregg@kktplaw.com with your full name and the episode numbers for the 10 shows you've listened to. Also, feel free to email me with questions, comments, or anything at all, and follow the show on Instagram and Facebook at Immigration Review, or send us a tweet at imreview, that's I-M-M, review. I'll be back next Monday for a brand new discussion. Until then, I'm Kevin A. Gregg, bringing you the Immigration Review.